Comments made on Serotalk Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Welcome to the latest Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft. Welcome to Serotalk Tech Chat 88 for February 3, 2011. This is Michael Loft. Tonight, our topic is This Month in Access Tech. We're going to cover the highlights of January 2011. Joining us this evening, I'm very excited to have Rodney and Aaron Edgar, hosts of the Tech Access Weekly podcast. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having us. It is truly awesome to be here.
Yes, it is.
The honor is mine. And folks, if you haven't listened to Tech Access Weekly, easily and conveniently located at techaccessweekly.com, I encourage you to do so. Between listening to them and Serotalk, you will be in the know for all the latest AT news. I mean, there's a lot of great podcasts, and I encourage listening to as many as possible. But the ones that dig up the news, go through the stories, and pick out what they think is most relevant and important between Serotalk and these two, you're going to get the meat. Also joining us this evening, this is a last-minute development. Very excited about it. Pete Bosley, our good old reliable, but Pete is going to give us some information. It was so ironic that last week we were talking about in Mike Cowell's truck about the EPUB 2.1. It's a forthcoming updated standard, and the exciting news is this is going to integrate DAISY, to my knowledge, full DAISY support into EPUB 2.1, therefore raising the question, will DAISY as a standalone entity be required, or can we actually migrate and get to a place where we promote EPUB as the means of communication for all future books and therefore make sure that accessibility is included with all the specifications. And what I was trying to stutter and stumble out and say last week was that there were like two components of DAISY that had already been integrated into EPUB, but I guess more is coming. But I'm going to leave it. Let me put this page up on the screen here. And Pete, I'll let you explain this. There's 14 objectives, I guess, they're trying to accomplish with EPUB 2.1. I don't know how many of them actually specifically pertain to accessibility, but I'll let you go through this and kind of explain really what all this means in the big picture.
So this standards body is attempting to update the EPUB specification, and there are things that have that they've decided to leave out of the scope. They're not messing with DRM, and you know they're not doing ISO certification at this time, but There's a push to kind of standardize with EPUB. These 14 items that are on this list are the things that the working group has targeted for the 2.1 specification. Now, this 2.1 specification may actually end up being called EPUB 3.0 when it's all said and done. The reason why they used 2.1 was to try to indicate that this was going to be something that was handled fairly quickly as standards development go. So I'm going to start here at top at number one, where it says the need for rich media and interactivity. And basically what that means is the current implementation of EPUB doesn't allow for native items like adding crossword puzzles, adding, you know, video applications and things like that inside of an EPUB book. So this, the goal is to allow software developers and publishers to create some of this interactive content. And I know that there are some implementations out there right now of EPUB that are doing that already. Some things that you see in some iBooks and things like that. But keep in mind that those implementations are largely proprietary builds by vendors. The second one is global language support. I'm going to skip that one because that's pretty self-explanatory. They want to make it more friendly to foreign languages. Article support is a similar thing. It's more about preserving layout for things like magazines and newspapers and other things like that. Metadata support. This kind of goes into a more technical discussion, and it's not very applicable to accessibility. Number five, page layouts. Now, page layouts are important to EPUB as a standard because in its current form, EPUB does not keep page numbering. So if you were to have a textbook on an EPUB book and you're working with some people that have the printed copy and they say, let's turn to page 345, currently there's no way to really know where page 345 really is. So this component here is meant to address that shortcoming. Navigation support. The current implementation of table of contents and jumping around a book is, again, one of those things that's handled by the individual implementation. The standards body would like to see that put into the standards so that all EPUB books would conform to a specific form of navigation, such as, you know, we have this table of contents going to this section, and that kind of ties back into the page layout thing as well. Incomplete alignment with broadly adopted web standards. This is another technical thing, more having to do with how EPUB books are displayed in certain readers. Basically, it's saying the technologies that were developed for EPUB are old HTML, older versions of that. So this is just meant to bring that kind of up to spec. Lack of annotation support. This is a really important one because, especially in the educational setting, when you're talking about things like textbooks, when you have a textbook or a reference book and you need to make notes or you want to take down something that you found in the book, currently there's no standard implementation for that. I know that there's some ways to make notes in iBooks and in some of the other applications, but the standard itself doesn't implement that, so this is meant to bring that into alignment. And it's interesting that they're currently trying to decide whether to use the Adobe PDF version of annotation or the DAISY, and I think that's going to be a struggle, but I'm fairly confident that DAISY is going to win that particular one. No native support for mathematics. Again, this kind of falls into the category of textbooks and science and math sorts of things. This is something where I think MathML is probably likely to make an appearance, but making a standard way for equations and mathematical items to be included in EPUB books. 11, insufficient accessibility support. So this really comes back to the meat of what we're looking at as far as our community is concerned. Currently, EPUB doesn't provide a way for multiple media types like text-to-speech or audio or video to be synchronized with things like captioning and other accessibility features. This item in this specification is meant to coincide with the modifications that are currently being addressed to the DAISY format and to bring those into alignment together. So the goal here is to make it so that DAISY books can be readily imported into EPUB format without having to do a lot of complex reauthoring. Industry-specific extensions, more technical stuff, not really applicable to accessibility. The rest of this is more about acceptance. So
right. So we'll quit there and let people kind of read that document, and we'll add it to the show notes. And of course, if you're viewing an accessible event, you can see it on the screen right now. So a couple questions for you, Pete, and we'll let Rodney and Aaron throw a few at you as well. But first off, the fact that they're not even worried about DRM or digital rights management is already going to mean that a lot of folks are going to continue to do their own thing. So let's talk about how is Amazon approaching this, you know, with the Kindle PC or iBooks, you know, what technology are they using to put their books out now? So how much is this going to mean at the end of the day?
Well, Amazon currently uses the MOBI format, and they've got a proprietary one called AMZ, the Amazon Book Format, which is just MOBI with their encryption on top of it. I don't know that we'll see them take a crack at moving to EPUB, just because Amazon is big enough to dictate an ebook standard. No one can really force them to do anything. On the other hand, if the standard achieves wide adoption, there may be pressure put on them to head that direction. And if that pressure is sufficient, we may see that happen. As far as them not addressing DRM in the standard, I think that, you know, regardless of whether DRM is addressed in this version or the next version, what you'll see is eventually the version 3 standard will be adopted, and then the DRM will be built on top of that. So hopefully by the time that the DRM standards are, the vendors are ready to put their DRM in place, we'll have a clearer idea of where this is going and whether it makes sense to standardize on a DRM.
Right, so there's already protected EPUB, so that means someone has already modded EPUB to give that protection to those documents?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So EPUB's kind of one of these things, oh, here, you start with this, and then here, we'll mod it over here, and so not all EPUBs are
EPUB. EPUB's similar to PDF in certain ways, in that PDF does not have DRM by nature. That was, you know, added on top of it, even though PDF was sort of developed by Adobe.
Okay, Rodney or Aaron, is there anything you want to throw at Pete on this subject before we go into? Because we have a wealth of other things to cover as well. But
I don't think there's anything I want to ask at this point.
Okay. I don't know. I think it's a good step in the right direction, probably.
Yeah, I mean, 11 sounds as typical when you talk about accessibility. They like to speak in it in very general terms, and we could read here and see how specific they get. So hopefully, they are looking at all forms of disabilities here. And I wonder if things like Blio, should we ever see it in an accessible form, you know, that claims that the content will scroll, you know, the highlighting will scroll with the text, so that'll help people with reading challenges.
Kind of cognitive disabilities.
Cognitive disabilities, or again, maybe where English is a second language, things of that sort. So, but that's a good overview there. So you heard it here first, folks. The other thing I want to ask you about, Pete, before we get into the meat here, you were one of the first today. They just sold out the pre-orders for the iPhone 4 for Verizon. I guess you actually got up at 3 a.m. Eastern and put in your order this morning?
Yeah, you know, everyone that's been conversing with me on Twitter knows I was kind of hardcore about this particular item coming out and switching to Verizon. So I did wake up really early this morning, and I did get on an order, and it was actually a very smooth process for me, at least. You know, I do know that there's some people that said they had issues, but the website was accessible. They actually had a couple of accessibility features in there. When you were selecting your plan, it asked you if you needed the accessible version, so that was kind of nice to see that Verizon had sort of thought ahead on that front. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I have a friend that works for Verizon Wireless in one of their networking departments, and he was telling me that everybody was kind of bracing for the impact. So,
well, yeah, I mean, you're going to bring in, and we don't know how many that is, but they sold, what, about 16 hours. So, you know, we're going to assume at least a million, but you're going to bring all these new phones online at once. They've already asked their own employees to hold off and make sure that they can meet the demand. Accommodate as many people as possible. I'd be curious when we see the breakdown of how many of these are newer. Well, these are all existing Verizon customers, so. But, you know, ultimately what the migration of people who switch. The other thing I wanted to mention, you, an article that you'd found and posted, which basically echoes what we'd already talked about, the fact that people making a choice between AT&T and Verizon, the fact that AT&T is better for data throughput, but Verizon is better for holding the calls. So if you're in a fringe area, if drop calls is a problem and really important for you, then Verizon may be that switch you want to make.
It looks so AT&T's 3G network is actually by definition much faster than Verizon's, and that's why I think that you see the difference in data performance.
So that's very exciting as far as the price points. We saw, you know, Verizon, we heard of, you wouldn't have the tethering capability, 2G, I guess, 2 gig for $20. That's in addition to you supposedly have unlimited data, but then I already posted something today that said that they will start capping down some of the more hardcore users, people that are sitting there trying to watch Netflix movies all day and really pushing the envelope of the data throughput. And then we saw AT&T with 4.3 may actually roll out 4 gig tethered for $45. So, you know, again, and that was my comment earlier today that, you know, 2 is great, but the friend in Columbus, Ohio once told me if you want real competition, you have to have at least 3 players. So we'll see if that happens. But we're very excited to at least see there's a second choice. And for all the folks in Verizon land, it just hate AT&T with all their might that there is now another option. So be curious, and Pete, we will certainly call you to task when you actually get your phone in hand and side-by-side comparison on how these phones kind of hold up. There's already 10 cases available because I guess there's a slight mod for the Verizon iPhone.
The mute switch has moved slightly due to the difference in the CDMA antenna configuration.
Right, very cool. We have a ton of articles here dating back actually a couple weeks here. So
if you look at the pictures that CNET released recently, the headphone jack actually looks like it's slightly shifted as well. So you might have to be careful with whether you get an AT&T or a Verizon iPhone case.
Okay. I didn't notice that.
Did it move to the right?
It looks like it moved just a tiny bit to the left if you're facing the top of the phone.
Okay.
Just slightly from the picture. I don't know whether that was just angle of the camera that they were taking it with or not, but it just looked like it was slightly ajar.
Yeah, I didn't have my show notes here. There was an article that said 10 cases that work with the new Verizon iPhone. So apparently folks are quickly getting up to speed. But right, anything that you may have, if you migrate from one to the other, it's probably not going to work for you.
Yeah, I actually called AT&T today just to try and see if they would actually... See if they'd actually upgrade the data plan. And they kind of looked at it and, you know, went away for like 5 minutes. And I'm like, okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, because I had changed the plan last spring, I guess it was, so that they would charge if you used internet access, which we had Blackjack 2s at that point, which were... greatly horrible for internet access. But they said, no, unfortunately, you can't do that. But they also kept saying that, well, no carrier actually offers unlimited access at that point in time.
We've seen some articles that says that they are, at least for some people, quietly restoring the ability to go back to the unlimited data.
I suspect that is the people that had whose contract expired and they're free to move along if they wish.
Exactly, those who are, so to speak, negotiable, that they're fighting keep, yeah.
Well, they'll restore your data plan to the unlimited if you had the unlimited plan prior to getting the current iPhone. So if you had, back in May of last year, if you had the unlimited data plan and you switched when you got the iPhone, they'll actually... upgrade you back to your previous plan. So that's kind of a neat little thing. And I didn't know, but if you are trying to get out of your contract, if you can get someone to actually take over your contract and your phone, you don't incur the penalty. So you can sort of transfer your contract to someone else.
And there have also been articles talking about how you can basically file complaints or write down every time that you dropped calls, and they gave suggestions of filing complaints with the Better Business Bureau and doing this and that, ways to kind of, you know, get yourself out of your contract by basically proving, documenting that the service, at least the calls aspect of it's not working for you reliably. So there are some ways to, but yeah, that's been around for quite a few years, that ability, if you can get someone to just take over your plan. It's one way that you can move on.
We just never had a problem with AT&T. It'll be interesting to see how well Verizon's network stands up to the barrage of iPhone users that are going to all of a sudden come on and use
a lot
of data. We never had a problem, even when we had, you know, our wonderful Windows Blackjack 2s, me with mobile speak. We got the iPhone and we still never had, we don't experience many dropped calls. I know that when I travel up to northern Indiana at Thanksgiving, I have terrible service, but I think it's terrible service all around because there aren't that many cell towers around where I'm at. So I don't think it's signaling out AT&T in any way, but we've just never had any difficulty. And I think, like I said, these new supposedly unlimited data plans with Verizon will test their
Well, at least they've had some. It's not like they went in cold like AT&T. At least they've had the the Android phones, and those are some serious bandwidth users. But you're right, if you bring a million new phones in and these people are hardcore and they're going to play with it and see what it's capable of. Now, Pete, you said the speeds are slower, so I'm curious, are they going to be able to sit there and do things like watch Netflix movies? And, I mean, what kind of speeds are we talking about?
It looked like the download speeds were within about 10 or 15% of AT&T's, and the upload speed is where the issue really was. So I think, you know, things like Netflix and Pandora and you know, things like that will be fine. I think where you'll have issues is where you're doing uploading. So, you know, maybe some of the things like Ustream, where you're streaming your camera out, or maybe even some of the voice over IP applications. It'll be interesting to see.
Exactly, Skype.
Work.
Yeah.
Dropbox, perhaps, if you use the Dropbox iPhone app for uploading files.
Right.
Well, actually, Kent German over at CNET released an article last night that was doing a comparison between the Verizon versus AT&T. Granted, in San Francisco, where AT&T service is literally
horrible, non-existent.
Yeah, to use my terminology.
Horrible.
but, I mean, the Verizon phone beat AT&T's iPhone in every single test except for like two. You know, as far as loading pages, it was faster. Loading, doing a little speed test as far as data downloads and things, that was all faster. But they can't get as many cell towers into San Francisco because of the ordinances as far as putting towers up on buildings.
Well, keep in mind that you know, AT&T is, you know, and I hate to be an AT&T defender, and by all means, I'm not. But AT&T has a little bit of a disadvantage in the vast majority of the infrastructure that they've implemented, because AT&T operates on a higher frequency. So they're at a 1900 megahertz and 2100 megahertz frequency, whereas the majority of Verizon stuff runs on 900 megahertz frequencies. So those of you that are familiar with radio waves, maybe Michael, you can explain that a little bit. But the lower frequency bands are better at building penetration, they travel further. So AT&T maybe have to put up 30-40% extra towers to cover the same area as well as Verizon does.
Also, yeah, the higher the frequency, the greater chance of dropouts, holes in the coverage, because it's line of sight.
They're more susceptible to interference. Correct.
Yes. All right, I'm sorry, I thought you were trying to say something to Rodney as well. But
No, you just said it.
Okay, very good. So I'm just saying, what else on that space? Also, I guess there will be the next iPad will work on CDMA for Verizon. A lot of folks are excited about that. And looking through, I guess, just other Apple stuff, they're relaxing their repairs on the sensors, or liquid sensors. That's a good thing to know. And, you know, it's interesting, we were talking about the removing the home button and whether that happens or not, because it's you know, A, it's one less moving component to wear out or even damage from moisture. But someone made a point I never even thought about. Without that home button, it doesn't matter which way you hold the phone. There's not that big button there. You can. There's no such thing as upside down, I suppose, at that point,
well,
as far as the screen.
If the locking button is still there, you know that that's the top and or left of the phone if you're holding it in, what's that mode that's not portrait? Landscape. And you know that the bottom where the charging mechanism is and the USB and speakers is the right.
I think they were talking about the actual screen. It was actually maybe screen real estate or something that they could recover.
They could use, I mean, there will be extra screen real estate if they took the home button off, I guess.
Well, the question is whether Apple will actually go to a larger screen than the 3.5 inch. That's the whole question. If they get rid of the button, they can keep the same form factor but extend the screen.
I would be surprised to see that happen, just because unless they found a way to keep the resolution scale the same, what they would do is put us application developers in a place where we would have to retrofit existing applications and write applications in so many different resolutions that that would be a surprise to see that.
It would be like Android.
Well, not quite.
Yeah, not quite. On a totally different subject, I'd certainly like to hear your comments, Rodney and Aaron, on the NFB Blind Driver Challenge. I know
Here we go.
Okay. Because some people are very excited about it, and others think, what a waste of energy. There's too many other things. There's Braille literacy. There's unemployment.
Oh, boy.
But you'll all get your chance, Aaron. Yes, you will. But I have to say, personally, I'm excited about it, not because I want to drive a vehicle, but just because of the many different spin-offs that can come out of this. And a great example of it, not only what NFB has done, but what Google has done and some projects going on in Europe. This morning here in Evansville, here's a perfect example of why I support this. It may sound off base, but it'll make sense to someone, hopefully other than myself. But this morning, someone pulled into a Steak and Shake. He was an older gentleman, was parking, and then, oops, all of a sudden hit the gas instead of the brake, plowed into the building, injured 10 people. Now, if we equip vehicles to be a little bit more intelligent, not only can they compensate for things like people falling asleep or, you know, preventing them from hitting something, maybe because they were texting or doing something that took their attention away from the road. So it's safety concerns. It's just improving the reliability of, you know, of the vehicles to be able to counter poor human judgment. That's one thing. But also just, you know, how we can take these technologies and carry them over into appliances and other technologies. But I'm going to start with you, Aaron. What are your thoughts on the project in general?
Let me say that I completely support this. Don't get me wrong. I'm not, it's not like Braille literacy. I'm not going to go into a rant about it. I completely support this. I think there are a lot of areas that need to be concentrated on in the blind community, I think, a little bit more at this point. I think that one of the steps is it would be great if Google and the other projects that are trying to automate vehicles as well could work together and share their knowledge and information. I think probably the best, I don't know if most appropriate is the right word, but I think the energy needs to be put first into developing the simplest thing, which is automated vehicles that can be run with sighted people first. Make sure that step is working well. Make sure there's some sort of standard in the way that the vehicles are produced. It would create less, I guess, confusion that way. And then try and put the non-sighted component into it. When everyone's working together and there's a standard that can be enforced, I guess, on both sides of the equation. I don't know if that makes any sense. If my legalese is coming over into my regular speech here. But I guess that's kind of how I see this going.
Well, it makes sense. I thought the same thing at first, and the more I think about it, I think it's good to have different entities and maybe even competing, because we don't want to stifle innovation by having everyone join one front and decide there's one way to approach this issue, maybe by having different parties look at it differently and come up with different solutions is certainly something we still want to have into place there.
I think that's a good point, and I agree to a certain extent, but I think there needs to be some kind of, I guess, maybe overarching series of principles that need to be followed. Like people decide that they want automation to do various different things, and to some extent, they work a little bit together to make sure that it applies to applies to sort of various basic things like a computer override if you accidentally hit the gas instead of the brake pedal, for instance, that all of the competing solutions apply to various, I guess, basic safety standards.
Any thoughts from you, Rodney?
Well, I kind of agree with her a little bit. I think probably a little bit of the air was let out of the whole project when...
Blind driver challenge?
Yeah, out of the blind driver challenge when... everybody sort of caught up to Robert Scoble and finally figured out that, hey, Google has self-driving cars that they have driven almost 200,000 miles and had very few human interventions throughout the hills of California. I think that is a big step. I think that the Blind Driver Challenge will help in that. I mean, it does actually give a blind person the ability to interact with the vehicle if it does go astray. You know, as far as trying to hit someone or going out of a lane of traffic, you know, give them some sort of a response to the environment around them as opposed to just relying on the car. I mean, they have every year the DARPA challenge where they try to do vehicles for military, you know, trying to get them to actually have autonomous vehicles. So that goes on every year. So, I mean, the development is there. It's just, will this actually lead to blind people driving? I don't see it right now.
Yeah, that's, you know, say at least 10 years down the road. Pete, you have partial sight. Is this something you would be interested in? I mean, if you could actually, you know.
From my perspective, it's really an interesting technological challenge. And I think that's sort of how I look at it. Personally, driving would be nice, but it doesn't really ruin my life. So I don't think that hard about it. But I definitely see the benefits in both of these approaches. I definitely think we should try to develop something where a blind person has as much information as possible about what's going on around them, and that we should not, pardon the pun, you know, blindly rely on the computer to make decisions for us. But you know, it would be nice to see the technology evolve to the point where it seemed okay to rely on the technology, and we have the other ways of knowing what's around us just in case, you know, we need to make a decision outside of that.
Definitely. Wow, we got a lot of stuff to cover. We're already halfway through the hour, plus we want to take questions. So let me move on here to a couple highlights from this year's ATIA 2011 event. I think one of the biggest ones, and I want to get Rodney and Aaron's opinions on, is the Open Braille Initiative. Apparently it's moving forward. They've come up with something they call the Open Braille Server. It's a little small piece of software. But what we're talking about, folks, is at least five of the six major Braille display manufacturers want to come up with a standard so that they can communicate, use their hardware Braille displays with all screen reading technologies and not have to rely on these drivers, be they sign drivers or just something, some kind of video chaining, and you know, that causes problems when installed on computers. So this sounds great, but it certainly, I guess, could throw a couple snags in the air if there are vendors who feel that they need to have signed drivers. So I'm going to start with you. I'll start with you, Aaron. What are your thoughts on this?
He's partially sighted and does the whole print thing, but I have some very strong thoughts on this, and I am a Freedom Scientific user. I use Spare products. I use JAWS as a screen reader, and I'm happy with it, and I'm happy with some of their note taking devices. I do think that the companies that aren't adopting this Open Braille Initiative or aren't, you know, putting themselves, I guess, behind it, want to protect their trade secrets, which I think is understandable to a point. And, you know, I hope that there would be a way to do that if, you know, companies should protect things about the way they put their products together, probably. But I would think there'd be a way to do that while putting yourself behind this initiative, because this initiative is a wonderful collaborative effort that helps to promote and keep Braille literacy, I guess, to heighten it. Because I have been doing a lot of research and reading on the subject since I'm just passionate about literacy, whether it be sighted or blind. Because I believe, along with a lot of educators that I have spoken with and read about their studies, that reading itself, the ability to read, learning that helps to organize your thoughts and keep you thinking in a logical and coherent manner. If you, you know, lose your sight when you're older, you know, you learned how to read print when you were younger, and I think you still keep that ability. With the lack of special education teachers now, especially in the U.S., especially also special education teachers who don't know Braille, there is a less Braille literacy has gone down, especially with blind students, and also with the increase in audio feedback from computers, which I couldn't live without and do my job every day and live. I think, though, that people have been relying on it maybe exclusively, especially when they're young and not learning how to read. And I think that is sad. I think that this Open Braille Initiative will help develop sort of mechanized Braille, if you will, hold a standard for Braille displays that can carry over regardless of what screen reader you're using, and will help maybe in the long run promote people, you know, buying displays, not having to worry about what screen reader they're using in order for a display to work. So it could promote, you know, people keeping their Braille skills up, and even schools buying displays for kids, because technology is kind of outpacing. The paper and pencil is going the way of the dinosaur to a great extent with learning. I do think that there's another side to the coin in that Braille displays are very expensive. I myself cannot afford them. That has something to do with the way that they're manufactured at this point. The technology is somewhat expensive. Also, the manual labor that goes into all the little bitty motors and thingies that go with each pin. I do think that this initiative is fantastic, and I hope it continues.
Yeah, it raises some good points, because what happens if Freedom Scientific decides that they don't want to comply, or they still want signed drivers to work with JAWS, and then which is a gamble because then, you know, they could, the schools would have to decide, well, do we want to stay with JAWS or, you know, do we want to go with some other technology because these are the displays we have. So it's
right.
Certainly a lot of decisions will have to be made, tough decisions.
Yeah, I know. And I think one of the reasons that some of the screen readers are so expensive is because government pays what they believe should be paid. I think it started out as people not knowing how much something was worth and, you know, taking a company's word for it, and the company would give, I'm not saying Freedom Scientific is alone in this, by the way, you know, a higher price than maybe was required because they wanted more money for R&D, for instance.
Well, no, that's no different than the cell phones we were just talking about, you know, like you have window eyes. Well, why ask for less if people are already paying this price for JAWS? Or the announcement that Baum is going to bring Cobra into the States, and they've already decided, well, we're going to start it at or maybe just under $800. So you're saying,
yeah,
why?
I think I was trying to say the same thing. It just wasn't coming out.
I'm sorry I interrupted you there, a little Skype lag. So that's all that's going on, folks. We'll track that. The other couple things from the event, of course, was a Zoom reader. So an iOS $20 app for OCR. We'll see how it works, when it works, or when it's actually available in the App Store. And that is, of course, from AI Squared, called Zoom Reader. Also, WindowEyes 7.5 introducing remote access capabilities. No, that'd be nice that JAWS is not the only game in town for having that in the screen reader. And so we'll see how they implement it and how it works. Where Serotech is the only one that has it works cross-platform in the sense of working with other screen reading technologies. Right now all of them work, requires all users must have the same screen reader. And I guess they'll both be of the same that, you know, someone has to be at that other machine to allow access. Where System Access lets you remote into your home computers, assuming, well, they're yours. You know they're yours. So I know Rodney and Aaron, you just set up 7-day demos yesterday, so I don't know if you played with the remote access component of it yet, but that's certainly one of my favorite features, and I know many people love that component of it as well. But let's see what else was going on here. Now, I couldn't get any announcement, any official statement, but there was an article posted about a cappella speech coming to various HumanWare devices, including possibly even the Victor Reader Stream, but I couldn't get anyone to commit to that statement.
I have some concerns about that, especially if it comes to the Victor Reader Stream. I have a feeling that the stream itself has very small onboard memory, and when it came out, it was you know, fabulous, but I think it's becoming outdated. And since it has small sort of onboard memory, it can get away with that because the operating system is Linux-based, and the Nuance voices take up a lot less room in their stripped-down versions than the a cappella voices probably would. And it seems to me, and I've seen this concern aired on Twitter, and actually when I heard the a cappella voices might be coming to the stream, my first thought was, how are they going to sound? Is there going to be a lot of clipping? So is it going to be worth it to try and put them on there? I guess, you know, the only way, if they do come, is to find out and see how it works. You can always, you know, put on other firmware if you desire. Get the Nuance voices back if the a cappella really doesn't cut it with the, because they have to make the synth so small to put it on there. But if it does come, I'm really, I have a Victor Reader Stream and perfectly happy with it. It does what I need it to do. And I would be very, you know, very willing to try the a cappella and see how it sounds. They are great voices. I don't have them personally. I don't use them, but I have heard demos of them.
Sounds like a good opportunity for a product refresh.
Yes.
That's a good point. Great observation there. I'm like you, Aaron. I have Victor because it came out. It was really the first of that breed. I don't know if I would buy another one. And I don't mean Victor per se, but just one of those devices, because now with iPhone and, you know, even my N82, I could read books and Audible and do about everything. I don't know if I would buy another blindness-specific product like that. I do enjoy it. Like when I'm flying, it's great. It's small, and I can load a lot of content on there. And
yeah, it's like at CES, they were demonstrating a new one called the Digital Milestone, and it looks great. It does a lot of really cool things. I think it may rival the Bookport Plus in a couple of things it does, and maybe the, oh dear, what's the other one? There's another one. and a digital reader that I just for some reason can't think of. And it may rival those, but it is a little pricey, and it has some accessories that make it unique, but you need other pieces of hardware for a lot of them to work, which are also pricey. The barcode reader and the color identifier, to name a couple.
Oh, okay, yeah, you're talking about the Milestone 312, yeah, which is $449, and then, right, the color identifier, which was, what, $250, and then I think the
barcode reader is
barcode
like
was $900. Actually, I did an interview with them. I think JJ did as well, but go to CyrilTalk.com. We did 25 interviews, and JJ did quite a few, and a few of ours were the same, but a few we actually covered some different vendors. And we talked about that, maybe even working more collaboratively to make sure that between us we work and cover different spaces and try to get in as many of the vendors as possible. So,
And I mean, I'm like you. I use my iPhone for a lot. Color identification, barcode to some extent. I'm still fooling with those applications to get them to work. But they were a lot cheaper than, you know, say the color identifiers you can buy as hardware and the barcode readers also. But I use my Victor still for NLS books primarily and some other things, and Audible books and things like that. But it, like I say, it does what I need it to do. I don't need an NLS player. It's not quite as portable as the Victor, and I don't feel like I need to spend the money to buy a newer digital reader that's you know newer and has more onboard memory and newer things. But, well, but maybe that will change. I don't know.
I don't know if you've played with this app called Balaboka, but you can actually use it to create MP3 or Windows Media, all M4A, all different types of audio formats from different text to speech. It'll use any TTS engine on your computer, saved any number of different formats, so then you could load it on any player, be it proprietary like Victor or Bookport Plus or a mainstream tool. So there's a lot of options.
Balabook is really, really kind of amazing. Sorry, kind of jumped over you there, Michael, but we at OSU we show that off at some of the conferences that we go to. That you know, people come up and they'll see all the assistive technology that we have set up there, and you know the universal thing we get from educators that are looking at that is, well, where do I buy this? How much does this cost? And it's like it's free, and this program is just amazing.
I'd love to try it. Kurzweil 1000, I use that for scanning, and I've been using it for so many years since version 4.5, and it has the ability to convert using whatever speech engine you want files to MP3. It's a little finicky with Windows 7 though, which is what I have now, and so you know that app will definitely be something I'm going to look at, since it's not that reliable with Windows 7, at least version 11 is in doing that.
Yeah, this Balaboka is incredible, and I just found, you didn't know the way I found it, was the Mashable Awards.
I didn't see it there. But,
or maybe I'm confusing. I know that's how I found Fizey. They won the award, which I was going to talk about music here. If either of you played with the Hope app, that it's $10 that Christopher Toth wrote for accessing Pandora.
That is awesome, though. I use Pandora on my iPhone when I do use it. I may purchase it at some point, but I had to have Rodney register me on Pandora's website because I just couldn't get the registration to work. But I think Rodney played with Fizey today a little bit.
Yeah, I played with that a little bit. Interface is very simple. You know, I mean, it's kind of funky the way it will just all of a sudden start playing a YouTube video. I'm not quite sure what that will do with a screen reader when it pops up. But it does give you the ability to search for songs and sort of go through a whole list of things. I was trying to find one song in particular, and I could not think of who it was. And I just typed in the song title, and 50 options came up, and I could just click on each one and go through it until there it is.
It looks like you can make it play, like if you want to hear every version of a song, then you could just, bam, just go through and play every version of Feelings, or whatever you're into, you know? That was I thought that'd be, I'd pick a different song, but kind of neat. You could just, if there's a song you really loved and want to hear every different version ever recorded of that song, it was a pretty cool feature, so.
I wonder if they have the Sesame Street version of that song. That freaked me out when I was a child. It was like Spike Lee with Sesame Street. It was weird.
Very bizarre. Before I open up for questions, I do have to talk about NVDA.
Oh, yes.
This is an interesting situation, folks, because you know, it's important that there be some free solution for those who truly can't afford it, and so at least we can make any computer talk anywhere. And that's, you know, we've stepped up to the plate with SA2Go. While System Access is certainly not a free screen reader, and there seems to be confusion about that, SA2Go is something used for an occasional use when you're somewhere where you simply need to make that computer talk, and as long as you have an internet connection and sound card, well, there you go to SA2Go. So we've always supported NVDA and their ability to actually have a physical free screen reader that maybe people that are on dial-up or, you know, live somewhere that's the only option they have. Well, it's evolving. It's coming along nicely. And now to hear that, well, maybe after July it won't be around because as of now we don't have grants to procure it. And so I look at that. I don't know what their operating costs are. It looks like they got a $300,000 grant for a year to pay two people. So I don't know, you know, if these people need to make $100,000 a year for them to continue the support. I don't know what the overhead costs are for the servers and the downloads and, you know, what all is involved in making that happen. But so the two related things to that are that, A, there's already a 2011 Beta 1, which I've not played with. And you can also listen. We have a link here. Randy Rusnak did an interview on his Accessible Devices Podcast 17, which I've downloaded, haven't listened to yet. So you can kind of get their perspective on what's going on with NVDA, and you can actually make a donation if you wish to give financial support.
Rodney listened to that.
Yeah, I listened to that just before this, and they're trying to take donations. They have PayPal. I believe I was doing three things at one time, and they either raised $9,000 or $19,000.
$9,000, what I heard, yeah.
$9,000? Okay. In the first installation of trying to get donations after putting their blog post up. It's a lot of, they work out of their home, they're trying to develop and continue developing, but it's like a full-time job, so developers need money too.
I have, quite frankly, been waiting for this to happen, and it doesn't surprise me one bit with the way the economy is going. I mean, I'm not only thinking in the U.S., but the U.S. economy impacts a lot of the world, and the whole world is having some troubles as a result of U.S. troubles, and I've been kind of waiting for the grant money to go down and for them to say, well, you know, we can't afford this anymore. There is a risk of relying too heavily on grants. Now, I do think, like you, Michael, that it's very important for people who can't truly afford it to not have to purchase a screen reading solution. I also think that for people who can't afford it, you know, the vision is great, but I think there's a limit to it. And I think it wouldn't really bother me to pay, you know, just a little bit for this as an accessory. I mean, obviously, it's something that we as blind people need, but it doesn't seem like to me, and I can afford to pay, you know, $50 to make this work. I don't think that's unreasonable. Other people, you know, might disagree, of course, as to the value of the price, but it may be hard for them to determine, you know, who can afford and who can't afford. And it'd be interesting to see if they just opened it up for donations and opened it up, you know, when you first downloaded it to say, if you can afford to pay such and such amount and give you some choices, how many people would actually do that?
Well, and I thought they had an opportunity to add eloquence, and I think it was going to cost about $30 a person or something, but they didn't want to gamble on buying whatever the block of licenses that they needed to do that or something. There's 300 licenses for $4,500, so it would have been 15 a license, so they could have recouped the money, but they didn't think that many people would do it. I think getting it in another voice might be a helpful incentive. Of course, there's already a modded version floating around the internet. Someone's already modded it to come up with eloquence by default. But that's another story. We don't condone that. We can't. But it is out there. Yes, it is out there. But I think it's important, and I actually gave a small financial contribution because I believe in the project. There are times I walked up to computers, had no internet at all, and to be able to have that NVDA on a stick that I could sit there and run was helpful to me at the time. Of course, now my SA2Go works that way as well. My System Access functions that way now. But not everyone may have that. So that's, you know, we certainly want to see it out there. I agree with you. We don't want someone to say, well, you don't need to buy a screen reader. Here's NVDA or here's Narrator. And there's always that concern that Microsoft, because of pressure from Apple, as they're, you know, making a bigger stronghold in the education space, that Microsoft might throw something in a future version, Windows 8 or whatever, and say, here, we got a screen reader now. You know, buy us for your educational institutions.
Mm.
So we'll have to see what comes of all that. We would welcome your questions and comments.
I will make one little comment there. I did send them an email and just pointed out that maybe something that they should look at doing is maybe putting a project up on Kickstarter to try and get people to fund it that way. A lot of people put little projects that they want to build little devices and things, and they can look for an iPod dock or something. It'll be, we only need $10,000 and $100,000 comes in. Also pointed out in an email to them that they probably would be benefited a lot if they were to contact Randall Schwartz over at Floss Weekly, and because they do everything open source, and they might be able to get some funding or some publicity that way because of the developers that watch and follow that show.
And a lot of people in the sighted community, quite frankly, don't even know that blind people can use computers with voice interaction from a screen reader to make them do that. And I was talking to Leo Laporte over at on the Twit Network on his Tech Guy radio show, and happened to mention that there was an NVDA out there. He had heard of JAWS because some people call into his show with JAWS questions, oddly enough. But he did not know that there was an open source screen reader, and he was very interested in that. And of course, I hung up before we could talk about it in more detail. But it would be interesting to get this word out to the sighted community and see if maybe they could even get more funding and recognition that way.
Great idea there. You mentioned Kindle PC. Have any of you played with it? I'm curious of your initial impressions. I actually went and bought one book just to put it through its paces, and I wish it had a continuous read rather than just doing one page at a time. But other than that, I'm excited to see that your 750,000 titles, this probably could be the biggest announcement from that sense for January.
I believe that it does have continuous read hidden in the keyboard shortcuts. Now, I have not played with it, so I don't know if it actually works. But Control-Shift-C is supposed to do continuous reading. We're going to have a Tech Access Daily tip coming out on the accessible Kindle, actually, just on a couple of functions, because I tend to keep these really short and sweet. But I did find that it worked very well. Like I said, I don't know if that continuous reading actually does work. I think it's a step in the right direction. You can't put as detailed notes and bookmarks, they aren't as precise as if you were doing it with the sighted version and or on a Kindle machine. But I think it's great. It's a good step in the right direction. Hopefully not too little too late. And we'll just have to see. And I think Rodney used it with Zoom Text and it actually worked.
Yeah, I installed it. It was a chore trying to get it to actually work because I had previously downloaded the original version back in October. And I uninstalled it, installed the new version, which does not tell you that it is the accessible version whatsoever.
Mm-mm.
When you look in the help or anything like that. And I never could get it to speak. So I uninstalled, rebooted, loaded it back up, and it was actually allowing Zoom Text to do the reading, or it was interacting with Zoom Text as far as the speech output. Seemed to work pretty good. I downloaded one book for that.
I downloaded a free book. I haven't actually thought of a book I want to pay for yet. but it seemed to like the Legends of King Arthur okay. It does not really read tables of contents, which some people might find really annoying. I don't really care that much.
It read in the book that I got, but it read the table of contents. I guess I'm kind of concerned that you have to get a different version. I mean, you can't just go and grab the one from filehippo.com. It won't work.
No, and that is a concern. And yeah, it won't. And when you to add to the problem, Rodney was saying it doesn't tell you it's the accessible version when you download it. It's not in the name, I don't think, and it's not in the name when it installs. Now, if you hit Control I, you do get some hotkeys for the accessible version. But that was the only way I could figure out that it really was the accessible version.
Now, I did see that in an article that was written about the accessibility was that they're going to make the accessibility plugin available at some point, but right now they do not have it to where it can easily be installed with the current client that does not have the accessibility plugin.
And I wonder if that's a concern for publishers, because some publishers really do not want their books to read speech out loud. And with the accessible version, all books in the Kindle store are read out loud. And I guess maybe the publishers are now okay with that, but don't want that ability for all their sighted users for whatever reason. I don't know. I haven't really read in detail, but that was my first thought when this came out.
I was talking the other day at the eTech Ohio conference at our ebook presentation. We gave a presentation on ebook reader accessibility, and I said, you know, I don't have any inside information on this, but I feel like Amazon has decided that text to speech as an accessibility feature is something that they're not going to allow the publishers to dictate to them. So, given what's happened with the accessible PC plugin, I think that the next version of the Kindle firmware will probably enable text to speech as an accessibility feature system wide.
I think you're right, and I hope so.
And are you okay with the limits on voices?
I wish you could use more voices. I'm not really thrilled with the Nuance voices, but I will say at least they don't use the vocalizer quality. It's a little better quality than that. And so I mean, it's fine with me. I used to read books with really, I mean, when I started reading really lengthy books in high school, they had the really, really crappy monotone robot voices because that's how old I am. So, you know, it doesn't bother me. The limits, male and female, that's perfectly fine with me.
Having a voice of any type is better than having to print it out.
Absolutely.
And read it yourself. Maybe that's the problem with literacy. Go figure.
That is.
Just answered the question.
Yeah.
Well, there's a few other topics we didn't get to as we reached our hour here.
We're fine for hanging around.
Okay, well, we can hang around a few other minutes here and talk about a couple other things here. Do either of you play games? I mean, we have the new Top Speed 3, Papa Sangre. Which
I listened to the demo of the Papa Sangre, and it sounds interesting, but I myself cannot tolerate RFI, and I don't know that I could get used to that. Brings me back to Haunted House on the old Atari back in the 80s, you know.
I play games, but I'm not one of those people who wants to spend a lot of money for games. Papa Sangre is a little too expensive for me. Now, maybe I'm just, you know, I don't know. $6.99, I guess, isn't too bad. But
well, it's down to $4.99 today. It's on sale.
Okay. Well, that's a little better.
Come on, $2.99.
Well, yeah. To me, the intrigue with Papa Sangre is it wasn't written for the blind.
Yeah, and neither was Orify, which I love. It's very addictive. Liam Irvin did a great demonstration on it, incidentally, on his podcast several months ago, which made me want to buy it. It's $1.99. It wasn't written for the blind, but a lot of blind iPhone users are gobbling it up because it's all sound-based.
So I want to ask you, Rodney, because you like me, you share the emphasis on, rather than creating blindness-specific stuff, is taking mainstream products and, you know, making them accessible so that we get the benefits of the savings and price, which was why, for those who still don't understand 2 years later, why we're so elated about the iPhone, is that finally you're not paying 1 cent more than your sighted counterparts to have the speech and all the things that go along with it. But what lately has excited you in that, as far as mainstream products that we've been able to use out of the box or with minimal modifications?
Well, the iPhone is the obvious choice. Everybody knows that one. I think Android is coming along. Everybody has to remember that the iPhone was out for 2.5 years without VoiceOver, so Android has to catch up. I think they're trying to just catch up to the iPhone, and that's just delaying accessibility to being developed fully. Biggest thing that I've seen recently is the processors that were announced at CES. You've got the Tegra 2 processor, and you also have the ARM processors that are going to be running Windows. So it kind of makes me wonder how many of these proprietary devices that you have, like the Victor Reader Stream, how much longer are they going to be able to hold on with old technology when in the palm of your hand you could have something like an Android Bionic phone that is going to be a 2 gigahertz processor. It's going to be as strong as probably the phone, the computer that you used to have sitting on your desk in 2002.
And I think also what speaks to that is it's not only computers and iPhones, but some of the digital, mainstream digital MP3 players, like I guess the Zenstone, although I haven't tried it, do have some accessibility features built into them. And I think that's fantastic. I also think the fact, of course, that the Mac has accessibility built into it to a certain extent is great. I think I still prefer the PC for a computer experience at this point, but I think it's great that you can get a Mac out of the box and it works with VoiceOver and some magnification.
And I think the Apple TV having VoiceOver on that is actually a big step, because everybody wants to have a set-top box that they can get their Netflix and videos that they download.
I wish I could operate our stuff.
Yeah, I have enough trouble myself.
So
yeah, and I hope there's some evolution with Ocean Blue, bring something, you know, so we can actually use the set-top boxes, you know, that you might get from your cable providers and actually be able to navigate the PVRs and, you know, go record shows and watch things on demand and queue and review through them and so forth.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with the FCC standards development and how those rules end up shaping out, because I think that'll have an effect on what happens with the cable boxes that get passed out to you by your cable company over the next couple of years.
I do want to cover this. I put a little bit here, accessibility and advocacy, and get some comments on this. One story here talking about, this is a Canadian woman who won a victory. She was trying to apply for a job online. The site wasn't accessible. She initially won, saying, yes, you should be able to apply online. And now, after that ruling in November, they want to overturn it and say, no, you know, you shouldn't, we don't need to make special accommodations. You can apply online. You can call on the phone, or someone can email you a form or something. And, you know, granted, this particular situation's in Canada, and we hope to bring her on. We want to do a tech chat on advocacy. That's kind of disconcerting. And maybe a little closer to home here, a story talking about a U.S. Federal Appeals Court. I can't talk tonight. Federal Appeals Court saying that, yes, this lady can use technology to take professional examinations. It's hard for you even to imagine that you go in to take a professional examination and someone say, no, we can't do this technology. And I hear this sometimes coming up even in universities. I guess there's a fear that some of the technology you're bringing in will allow you to cheat.
Yes.
Yeah, there is that.
I can speak to this because I can't speak a lot to the Canadian situation. I don't know if their standards for determining accessibility are different. The Court of Appeals leads me to believe, the fact that she actually won, and the judge's reasoning and legal brief, what I was able to read of it, leads me to believe that they are similar. And I think that the government is, in Canada's case, I think one reason is that they're afraid of change, and perhaps they're also just unwilling to spend the extra money and resources to make their sites accessible. She probably has a very different understanding, knowing the situation so intimately. So if you bring her on and she disagrees with me, that's perfectly fine with me. I'd be most interested to learn about that.
Well,
if the Canadian standards are different, and if my sort of hypothesis on why the government is reacting the way it is correct, the National Conference of Bar Examiners situation here in the U.S. Is something that, as an attorney who has taken the bar in North Carolina, I can speak to. Now, I did not have a problem with either the national examination being able to use technology or the state component in here in North Carolina. Now, they don't provide. The only thing I was provided was the examination in Braille automatically. That was not something I had to pay for or do. But they're not at this point obligated, as far as I know, to provide any further technology. I brought in a laptop. I brought in a proctor to help me fill in the multiple choice, because it's a little bubble sheet thingy. And I had to deal with those things myself. As far as the proctor, luckily I had friends who did it for free. Because it's a 2-day job, and I couldn't afford to pay someone at least minimum wage for 8 hours a day to do that. They were also generous in granting me extra time because of the fact that it takes blind people sometimes longer to do things, they were good about that, and I didn't have a problem. It shocks me that this actually was a problem in California, because, you know, you think of California and you think of
all states.
Yeah, of all states, exactly. I have a lot more liberal notions in some respects than other states do legally. And it was very sad, and I am glad that the woman won. I think it was well-deserved, as in the Canadian situation. And I see a lot of resistance. not so much with people I work with in the legal profession, but often there are people who are very set in their ways and don't really understand that people with disabilities can be high-ranking and, you know, official individuals in that profession, and are leery of letting people who have disabilities practice the law.
You know, it's you see this a lot. You see this a lot with academic situations where there's an authority, a body that certifies you for something. And you know, I've seen this myself in some of the certification exams that I've had to take, where you go to them and you say, "I have a disability. This is the technology that I use as my accommodations." You know. I'll still complete the exam to the same standards as everyone else. I just do it a little differently. And a lot of times there's a knee-jerk reaction like, "Oh, well, no, we don't make exceptions." It's like, well, you don't really have a choice.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to single out law. I don't think it's the only field, but it was, I was using it as an example that you just explained
sure,
a lot
better sure. than
I.
There's a story you're talking about. The FCC is seeking comments now on an 18-month proposal for a deaf-blind program. And this whole the whole communications bill that passed last year and now, you know, getting it implemented and leaving it up to the FCC and seeing so far that the blind community has not been very active in trying to make this happen. Did you read any of this particular article?
I can't speak to that, unfortunately.
Do you have much? Are you familiar with the whole Communications Act itself that was passed?
Not especially. Things dealing with the FCC confuse me.
So
I'm not terribly familiar with it. I don't know if Rodney or Pete have any, you know, any thoughts on it.
Yeah, I didn't get that far in the show notes.
Yeah, that's the thing when we bog it down with 47 links or whatever. But
half. If I knew you were going to skip half, I would have had time.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, I think this is a really it's a real shame that we as a community have not stepped up to the plate on that, folks. When these rule making procedures roll around and we find that we've been excluded from being considered as part of this process, we don't have anybody but ourselves to blame if we don't get out there and start telling the FCC the kinds of things we need in these communication services. If we don't get up and speak for ourselves, no one else is going to do it for us. So
I think you're correct, and it's not entities that are primarily sighted in nature or don't really deal with disability people with any disability on a regular basis have a hard time remembering that we exist, especially if we don't put ourselves forward. And I think a lot of times people with disabilities have to do that. And I think you're right that we haven't been coming up to the plate and doing that. It's kind of sad in a sense that we don't put ourselves forward more. We should. And I think the more that we do that as a community or even as individuals, the more we'll be taken notice of and taken seriously and maybe even asked in the long run what we need without having to tell people beforehand.
Well, social media is helping with that. People are on social networks. They're on Twitter. They're doing podcasts like this or ours. So, I mean, everybody's sort of getting a voice out there. People are doing twaudio things and cue audio recordings, little podcast things here and there. I mean, that's a big step because the community hasn't had that ability to make themselves heard. You know, you're when it was just a telephone and a modem for your computer to check the library or something, you didn't have that opportunity to communicate with people. Now you can blog, you can do all these other things to sort of say, "Hello, I'm here."
Yeah, I agree. It's much easier now.
Well, we pay the price. I mean, the deaf community, even the, you know, wheelchair quadriplegic community, they have made some advances that we haven't because they've unified and come in with numbers.
Yeah, I think with the blind community, I'm not affiliated with any big organization, and I'll tell you why. I don't like factions. I think that a lot of it is too much. There's a lot of faction affiliation going on, and you know, maybe to some extent that's good, but I think we need to somehow put that aside in a certain sense when dealing with the sighted community and unify our positions on a lot of things. And I think people being unwilling to listen to the other side is causing some problems and making the process happen slower.
I would agree. I guess, yeah, we did skip a few things for time constraints and then a couple other articles, but I guess at this point we'll let you just make closing comments. Or if there's any article that you did read that I posted here that you want to maybe go back and comment on, you know, any topics you were passionate about, what grabbed your attention, you know, since the beginning of the new year in terms of access technology or technology in general that you want to talk about?
I think we've covered all my things. How about you, dear? You're over there clicking your mouse.
Yes, I am clicking my mouse. Double-clicking, actually.
Pay attention!
As far as, like, the Blind Driver Challenge, I'll go back to that for just a minute.
Okay.
Alan Mulally, who is one of the higher-ups at Ford Corporation, he's said on previous occasions that they have the technology to make cars autonomous, that can drive themselves, interact, make sure that they don't do things that they're not supposed to. But right now, they're just trying to do self-parking cars and things just to sort of get the general public used to the idea. So to me, kind of the Blind Driver Challenge kind of puts that out there, you know, as, hey, there is the possibility that a blind person could actually drive. But whether that'll happen in my lifetime, not sure, you know. But I mean, it's trying to get the general public into the idea that it is possible, and more little experiments like that will be good. It just depends on who comes up with the idea for creating it. I would have much rather seen him go around the actual trioval at Daytona instead of the road course, but that's just me.
Interesting. I had the same thought. Yes.
My uncle drove NASCAR for 30 years, and you can't get any other experience other than going around a track that is banked like that. It's just amazing.
But, I mean, it did come off, you know, certainly there had to be concerns that it did come off. They had a mission, a plan, what they wanted to accomplish, and they did get that done. So I'm excited about that. You know, they know this is something at least 10 years in the offing, but that, you know, they went out with a goal and set that goal and accomplished it. I think it's exciting.
I do, too. Absolutely.
I want to jump back real quick to the Braille, Open Braille Initiative, because I was listening to that and thought that, you know, we as a community, I think, with all the technology that's out there, kind of forget the basics of Braille and literacy in general. I am partially sighted. I can read print, but I'm a Braille reader. I was taught Braille at a very young age, and I think that it's a valuable skill, even though I don't use it very often now, because I find that when I conceptualize how to spell a word, a lot of times I'll think about what it was like to read that word in Braille, because the English language, really spelling is not the easiest thing to do in English. So I really hope that this initiative does bring forth some increased Braille support. But I think that there's a challenge of cooperation in the community as far as the technology vendors go, and I think it's unfortunate that there seem to be some holdouts.
I agree.
And someone pointed out really quickly that the front page of the Open Braille had two
that
typos.
Was me. And they've been there for over a year. And I think part of it's my fault, because when I saw them initially last year, I kind of forgot to comment about them. And they're still there. They left out a word at one point, and they spelled initiative wrong at another point. And now that I know they're still there, I'm going to remember to comment on them.
Maybe you need to hook. And it's they need not, to hook up their Braille display and read their page over.
It's not just you know, websites produced by blind individuals that have typos on them. So I'm not trying to single them out. There are websites produced by basically blind and sighted people. Sighted people have, you know, just as many. And sad.
Well, I find once a week, right? I find a misspelling or something on a web page. Yes.
Yeah. Being sort of the grammar snob that I am, it's just. I just noticed those things.
Well, it's interesting. Also, I could not actually find. They said there was a 0.52 actual piece of software you could get, but I don't see that on the site.
I don't either. I don't see much there, actually.
Yeah. So I guess the final three stories I had here, one that I think's exciting, because I'm always worried I've lost my voice twice in the last year, which scares me. But the first successful Larynx and windpipe trance.
I think that's
pretty cool. You know, I have to wonder what the resulting voice was. Does it have any traits of the original woman from who it came, or does it have any similarity to the existing woman? Or I know there's a lot of factors that go into what makes up your voice.
Yeah, I wonder that too. And that was actually a comment posted, I don't know if you posted it or not, Michael, but somebody did, on the story on the blog that story came from. Someone posted, well, does her voice sound different now? And that was my first thought too, being so sensitive to people's voices that that's how I recognize people primarily. That was my first thought too. How does it sound? Does it sound like was it a masculine larynx? And so does it sound masculine that they got, or was it a feminine one? So
hey, now I want a designer voice. I want one of those deep, like, okay. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, don't we all?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wouldn't we all want to sound like this? You know,
people are trying to make customized text-to-speech engines that sound like your own voice. So designer voices, wow, that would be cool. You could have it perfect. You
could see if I can get Mike Calvo to donate some of his genetic material to mimic his voice.
Well, that's why I was so intrigued with that project, where you could basically build your own voice. But unfortunately, it never went much further. And then that's too bad, because I always thought that would be that's my idea of cloning. You know, I'll live on. I'll make a voice called Mike Talk or something, you know.
I cringe every time I hear myself on recordings, and I think there'd be celebrations in the streets if I lost my voice. So I think I'll just leave that one.
I can remember doing that like with ICQ, making recordings of my own voice, you know, and then every time it would freak you out to hear your own voice prompting you for things. It's like, whoa.
Yeah, I agree. I've gotten into internet broadcasting on internet radio as well.
MushroomFM.com.
Yes, shameless plug. The Melting Pot, 7 p.m. on Sundays. I still have, and I thought, well, I'll get used to my own voice, but I still have difficulties occasionally when hearing it back on recordings. And
Yeah, people say I have a voice for radio, but I figured it was probably meant to be that I had a face for radio.
Yeah, that's what they tell me. So this website my son introduced me to, quickie.com, quiki.com. Interesting that they use what you have is you type in a search term and it actually shows you a little demo. You have NeoSpeech Julie, and some guys just love Julie, so there you go, guys. But also it's showing little pictures kind of describing, you know, what it's talking about. But it's interesting the results you get. That's something to go play around with. Not quite up there with Wikipedia, but interesting.
Yeah, it's okay. I don't like Julie. She sounds like the biggest airhead that ever lived, at least in my...
It's a guy thing, Aaron. And I notice, like, sometimes I'll speak with older ladies and I go, you like Julie? And well, no, my husband does. You know, I'm like, okay.
That's women have responses to certain voices too, so I mean that's fine. It doesn't bother me. I know that Nuance Australian Lee voice, just he sounds so wow, you know, and I think I know a lot of women who really like his voice, so I mean I get where people are coming from.
Now this article, I'm sorry, I mean to cut you off here.
Go ahead.
This article intrigues me. This is one that Joe found. It's labeled Service Animals Go High Tech, Dog Guided Remotely by Stealth Technology. Basically, what this was is they found a little pack that they can put on the dogs and actually send vibrations to them and control them remotely, basically allowing dogs to go into dangerous situations instead of humans. I'm trying to see the relevance on how this would help for service animals. I'm not getting that part.
Well, it's basically putting a jacket on a dog that has sort of GPS and capabilities. So I guess you could give the dog feedback as far as his surroundings, kind of like a Google car. A Google car can use the GPS sensors to figure out, okay, there's a car beside me. Maybe that's kind of what the dog would get, you know, a little pressure here and there saying, hey, don't go that way. You're going to fall off or you're going to run into something maybe. I don't know.
You mean like initial training?
Yeah.
Yeah,
maybe you could have service animals that did not have to go through the massive amount of training. Or
I don't know about that. I think I'd rather just keep the trained animal.
Well, I think I see benefits of it out after the training, especially for you. If you are really the computers are guiding the dog for a good bit. Humans have some control over that too. And I think, you know, you would have maybe a better sense of your surroundings as well. I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know. But I mean, I do see the benefit of it for, you know, non-service dogs, dogs that are, you know, going in looking for drugs or going into a dangerous situation looking for, you know, bodies or cadavers. But service animals, I don't quite understand the benefit either.
Now, does anybody have any comments on the eyes-free accessible Google keyboard or the Chrome OS having a Chromebox? I know Joe was writing up something.
Pete, I haven't seen it, but Pete, I know, played a little bit with that. Didn't you actually have the OC48?
I haven't played with the keyboard, but the netbook, the Chrome OS, I have seen that. I didn't see any real accessibility. There was a little magnification, looked like. But I didn't see any kind of speech.
I read an article that said that it may be coming out, but nobody knows quite when. And they got the computer under the impression that it was out, and yet it really wasn't. I guess an inside source or somebody familiar with the technology said it wouldn't be out for another couple of months. I don't know.
Okay, yeah, because the only thing I really saw was some slight magnification abilities, but there was no speech.
Yeah, the article implied the code is there. They just have to throw a switch and actually activate it. So it's something partially implemented in that Google style.
I'll have to look at that. If the code's there and it's just a switch that needs to be flipped, I'm happy to go ahead and flip it. But
Well, I mean, they can do it on their end. Or, yeah, Pete will hack it and figure out where it is and be the first to make that thing talk. Or is it another Chrome upgrade or something, OS upgrade, before you can actually make it happen? I don't know.
Maybe they feel like they have to do more experimentation, but they wanted to get at least some of the code in there before they put out a final upgrade. I don't know. Typical Google, right?
Has anyone found out what's going on with... Now, I've been looking through when I downloaded the Android Honeycomb SDK stuff, it looked like there was another section in there called accessibility scripts, and I really haven't had a chance to look at that, but I was kind of wondering if we knew what those were.
I haven't seen anything on that yet.
Yeah, I don't know. Did you? Was there anything of Honeycomb itself that impressed you, Pete, yesterday?
No, I mean I haven't. I downloaded the stuff and I kind of started to mess with it and just been so busy I haven't had a chance to really get into it. I didn't even really watch the announcement.
I mean, it was more of a just a here's what Android can do and here's how nice our interface is going to be for you. You know, with the swipe. And all that. I didn't see anything that was really groundbreaking whatsoever.
Okay, Mike Arrigo comments that he does have the on-screen keyboard working with his Nexus One. So the on-screen keyboard that... that's interesting. Nolan's on-screen keyboard. Okay.
It's continually amazing to me that... Nolan, and Nolan's a bright guy, but Nolan has done things that Google, with all its resources behind it, just haven't seemed like they've been ready to do, and it just makes me shake my head sometimes.
Well, yeah, like you know, Ranger just commented here. Well, the new marketplace. I assume he's talking about
the web based one. Yeah.
Yeah. Market. What is it? Market.android.com or what is it?
.google.com, I believe it was. Not sure.
I thought it was market.android.com. Well, that's great. I'm like, well, it's about time. You know, if your Google's happy their apps aren't moving like iOS apps, well, yeah, Marketplace. The push to the apps, like you can be on your notebook and say, oh, here's an updated app, and then push it right to your phone. I guess that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Some video enhancements. Yeah. CNN's doing some stuff. I saw the Disney where you could actually interact with it and comment on songs. And I like the concept, like with CNN, you know, the actual news, you could actually sit there, be in an event, and record it, and then upload it. So that's good from a marketing standpoint. Imagine, you know, you big national news organization like CNN, and you could build an app, and then let your users, your viewers, actually go out and get stories for you. That's just good marketing that allows them to get pictures and audio and content, just like today I mentioned this accident. Fortunately, it wasn't a big deal, but easily some of those people could have been killed, and if someone had been there and done that, well, that would have done CNN's job, you know, by the time they got someone on site. So
But, you know, they did get in trouble a few times with their reporters, citizen reporters sending in things and then them actually reacting on them in the past couple years. You know, so it kind of makes you wonder, okay, are they just going to take these videos that they receive from an app like that and just post them? You know, is there credibility issues that they might have to worry about as opposed to just going for, okay, this looks great, let's do this?
Well, I think that I think that the industry as a whole needs to adjust to the times, and I think that accepting a video at face value probably isn't a great idea. But maybe the app sends along GPS coordinates, and they do a little bit of fact checking on their own, and they decide that they can kind of annotate the video or whatever. But I think that the days of the traditional way of reporting news are kind of over with, and so. It would be nice to see more things like the daily newspaper that was just put out on the iPad. Things that kind of advance that
which is not accessible.
Unfortunately, yeah. It is not. That's something that we should try to get on.
Do you really want it?
Some people.
Well, yeah, if there's more audio and video, yes, I would.
Here's the thing. I think we've this is kind of a little bit of an off-topic rant, but I think that the days of blogs and some of this so-called instant news have kind of eroded some of my trust in the news that I get. I like to read a newspaper article because I assume that a newspaper article has been fact-checked and well-researched, and I would pay for the daily newspaper, I think. Given that I would assume that the quality of the content would be higher.
What's funny, Rodney mentioned that because my comment, I wasn't enough characters said in Twitter, was, well, I might have when their news was fair and balanced. But so I don't know the particular source, but yeah, conceptually, they're designed for reliable information that's accurate and timely. And like Pete said, where there's fact checking going on and it's not just someone's opinion.
Well, it's one of those things where do you pay for an edition that came out earlier in the day as opposed to going to like CNN.com, because the comments have been made a few times on some of the other podcasts that the daily news, well, it's going to come out and it's only going to give you the current edition. It's not going to give you the 20 times that you went to CNN.com to get a live update or something for all the stories that came in since lunchtime. It's going to be one day's worth of data, and that's about it to start with.
But newspapers...
Go ahead.
Newspapers have to reinvent themselves. A great example, Indianapolis Star has switched focus to writing more detailed, thoroughly researched news articles, and that's what they're going to have to do if they want to survive. I mean, even New York Times dropped revenue 26%. They're going to have to reinvent themselves to show their true talent as journalism and actually cover the stories and give you something that we can't get for the quick, instant gratifying news that we get today through Twitter.
And now everyone that's watching this tech chat is like, "Where these guys have gone totally off the track."
Yeah, that may be.
We took it off track.
Yes, oh, well. We did.
Yeah. So I really enjoy your podcast, the Tech Access. I haven't really commented publicly on it or contacted you, but I just wanted to let you know that I think that's a great resource.
It really is. Tech Access Week, again, because we are going to put the wraps on here at 90 minutes, but I really do enjoy your work, and I encourage you folks to add that. Of course, it's on iBlink Radio and in SamNet, and very simple to go to, techaccessweekly.com. They really do a great job. And as I joked with them yesterday, of course, Rodney and Aaron can say things to each other that Ricky and I can't, So that's. And she's like, well, like what? I'm like, those things that married folks can say.
Stuff that I'm not going to say.
Right, stuff I'm not going to say.
But, we started this on a whim and didn't quite know where it was going to go. And it's gotten, I wouldn't say easier, but, maybe to a certain extent it is, but. It's gotten to be sort of a part of our lives now, and very enjoyable to do, and our interactions with one another have gotten on the podcast. More, you know, we don't have to think about it as much, how we're going to say things. But we maintain our independence so that we can say what we want to say and try and get our views out there. And I think it's important for us and the type of podcast that we want to do to be able to be independent and state without having to feel like we're restricted in any way.
And being picked number 4 on the Ouch blog kind of gave us motivation to continue.
Yeah, it was so totally amazing. I was floored. Absolutely floored.
Which Saratech was, what, 2?
Yeah, I believe we were 2. And I don't know if they were rated by number. That's just maybe the way they listed them. But anyway, it was very exciting to see both of our podcasts there.
Yeah, and we're on the subject. Really do appreciate those folks on the Blind Bargains Access Awards that nominated us. That's perfectly awesome. We never expected that either. So thank you so much, all of you, for your support.
Yeah, and if anybody hasn't listened, we try to take mainstream topics that might be important to people, you know, Facebook things. You have to worry about privacy. Where is that privacy going to impact you somewhere else? You know, things that you need to consider. And then we throw in the accessibility stuff also, so it's kind of a hodgepodge of topics.
What about the big honking security hole in Internet Explorer this week?
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yawn. They haven't proven that actually exists. They believe it does exist in the wild, but they haven't actually had any confirmation yet. The biggest one that everybody needs to do is if they use Facebook to tell all of their family to enable the HTTPS encryption. If you're curious about that, you can listen to a daily tip today from
Tech Access
feed.
Daily Tips.
TechAccessWeekly.com.
We did the daily tip just today. Put it up.
Yeah, definitely. I'm gonna go ahead and second that because, you know, if you're anywhere where someone can capture your network packets, I can ruin your day with your Facebook account. So, and it's not even really that complicated. So, yeah, definitely under that setting, you definitely want to turn that on.
Sounds like a good point to put in wraps. Otherwise, we'll be sitting here talking all night. But we thank all of you. And if you, I know it's kind of late now, but I think Aaron and Rodney will and Pete all join us in the actual tech room at Saratech for a little bit if you'd like to talk one-on-one for a few minutes. And again, check them out at techaccessweekly.com. Of course, this and the remaining 7, giving us a total of 25 recordings at this year's ATIA 2011 over at serotalk.com, and we're looking forward to CSUN and already lining up interviews there, and always tough to figure there's so many, you can never get all of them, so we're excited to do that, and it takes all of us. It takes every single person, Randy Rusnak and everyone else out there to cover. There's just so much going on, and some are like, well, someone's already covered that. Who cares? I'd like to hear a second or third interview because the stuff that JJ and I both interviewed, we both got different responses. We were able to catch up with different people or sometimes catch them a little not as busy, or the fact that, okay, yeah, I forgot to mention this in the first interview. So that's always good, and we're all excited to be out there and give you the information, folks. I guess all we ask from you is your 2 cents. Give us some input. Let us know what things you want to see covered. I don't know, do you guys have issues with apathy? I do. It frustrates me at times. It really does. But anyway, come over and join us in the tech room for a few if you like. And join us next week. We'll be speaking with Jim Fruchterman about a whole variety of cutting-edge technologies that he's working with. And look forward to some other great tech chats. We do this every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Until we meet again next week, we tell you to stay connected and stay directed.
This concludes another Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.